The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 136, In Defense of Mormon Schmaltz, with John L. Needham, Tom Kimball, Elizabeth Smart, Tracy Smith, and Jeanette Watts.
Good day. My name is John Needham. I'm the moderator of this panel discussion entitled In Defense of Mormon Schmaltz. There are but four panelists, unlike what the program states. The fifth was not able to join us. We'll begin with a couple introductory remarks by myself on the intent of this panel, what we want to accomplish, and then a few statements on, or rather questions that we would like to try to answer or at least leave in the air after we conclude. I'll introduce myself and then each panelist in turn as we move from one to the other. My name is John Needham. I am a native of Logan, Utah. Grew up there and live there now. I completed a degree in French and liberal arts a couple of years ago at USU, and am now a master's student in American Studies, where I'm doing a thesis on the fiction of Levi Peterson, Judith Friedman, and a few other Mormon writers. I work full-time for The Book Table, an independent bookstore in Logan that has been in business for about 60 years. We specialize in lots of things, but especially Mormon, LDS merchandise, books, and so forth. So I have some connection with the LDS marketplace and the schmaltz that we're going to discuss. I've been involved at this bookstore in a series of events as well, that is, authors who visit the store to make presentations on their books, novelists, Mormon theologians, and so forth. And this has brought me into contact with all types of Mormon writing and, again, schmaltz, and I'll be referring to some of these contacts I've made in my remarks. It seems that the typical sacrament meeting talk includes an opening disclaimer or two. So in keeping with the form, or the forum where a lot of Mormon schmaltz is pontificated, I'll go ahead and do a couple disclaimers. When we took on this subject, I speak for the other panelists, have realized how overzealous we were to take on an enormous field, that is Mormon popular culture and all of its subfields. Likewise, I think we must confess that we are individually not so much authorities in this field. We are all students, or we work closely with the material we'll be discussing, but we are not PhDs. We don't have books behind us. We are just kind of taking pot shots at the material with the hope that our gut feelings will actually make sense, or that they will lend or shed light on our topic. So again, with those disclaimers, we begin. And then I think the typical sacrament meeting talk also includes the Webster Says definition, so I'll begin by defining our terms. Schmaltz, according to the American Heritage Dictionary, is something that is excessively sentimental or maudlin, that is, art or music associated with those qualities, whereas popular culture, which is what we are really referring to by the word schmaltz, is, to look at the word popular specifically, fit for, adapted to, or reflecting the taste of the people, or suited to, or within the means of ordinary people. Culture, a term that's probably the least or the most challenging to define for our purposes today, is of course not capital C high culture, but rather the emotional, spiritual, intellectual qualities of a people. So again, we'll be looking at Mormon schmaltz or Mormon pop culture from a number of angles. My remarks are going to be rather random. I'm going to kind of tackle a number of ways of looking at the LDS book industry, LDS book and merchandise industry, and then things that spring from that industry. But before I do so, I think it would be appropriate that that I make our case, that is our defense, that I explain what we are attempting to defend, and that is that Mormon pop culture is worthy of study. And if we look at Mormon publications, that is, publications in Mormon studies, we do not find a lot of consideration of Mormon popular culture. This is kind of schmaltzy scholarship, but I did do some word searches in Sunstone indexes and dialogue indexes, again, just a couple of publications, and found very little systematic analysis of Mormon pop fiction or music or visual arts. There is a small article here or a comment there, but there has been really no direct attention made to what it is we find in our local LDS bookstore. I think this is interesting, and it's explainable, and I think the remarks of Michael Austin, a young Mormon literary critic who just completed a PhD, kind of shed light on why we perhaps don't look at Mormon pop culture seriously. He explains, "I would like to go on the record as saying that I approve of Mormon schmaltz and think that it is a valid form of cultural expression that has been unjustly maligned by literary critics who object to its simplicity and its faithful reproduction of basic values. I believe that cultures tend to produce what they need and that there are perfectly valid reasons for any kind of art that rises to prominence in a given community. In the case of the various genres that I have collectively labeled Mormon schmaltz," it is this article by him that we have taken our term from, "their functional utility is fairly easy to ascertain, at least on the surface level. They make people feel happy, they reaffirm our culture's basic values, and they teach doctrinal lessons in direct, engaging ways. To be sure, they also teach their share of false doctrine, but so do most Elders Quorum teachers, and the Elders Quorum teachers don't even have much fun doing it." So I think we avoid Mormon schmaltz, as someone remarked as we began here, because it's contagious. It's something we don't want to be associated with. It makes us, as either Mormon students of Mormon culture or scholars of Mormon studies, look somehow less scholarly. But the institutional church, that is the LDS church, is paying attention to the popular sensitivities of Mormonism. In the June 1977 issue of the Ensign, in the "I Have a Question" section, there is a question raised. It reads, "What is the proper way to respond in a classroom setting to inquiries about sensational or questionable gospel subjects discussed in the news media, LDS popular press, or non-church sanctioned symposia?" The question is then fielded in a very correlated way by a former church curriculum department manager, indicating that the brethren or the general authorities or the institutional church itself is observant of what is going on in our culture and do pay attention to it and address it in the church's primary publication. But I think probably the best reason why we should pay attention to Mormon pop culture and that we should defend its study is for the insights we'll gain into our own spiritual lives as Mormons or into the culture at large. In a book published last year, Colleen McDaniel, this is what it looks like, entitled Material Christianity, she writes of what we learn or gain from the study of material culture, specifically religious material culture, in describing a photograph that appears at the beginning of the book that pictures a young black or African-American family which has a number of works of religious art on the wall. She explains, "They practiced their religion as one would practice the piano in order to become a competent pianist. The symbol systems of a particular religious language are not merely handed down. They must be learned through doing, seeing, and touching. Experiencing the physical dimension of religion helps bring about religious values, norms, behaviors, and attitudes. Practicing religion sets into play ways of thinking. It is the continual interaction with objects and images that makes one religious in a particular manner. Each of the case studies presented here demonstrates how the material dimension of Christianity may be used to decipher the meanings of religious life in America. Studying material Christianity lets us see how the faithful perpetuate their religion day in and day out." We can simply include the word Mormon or Mormonism here to gain the same understanding that in looking closely and systematically at Mormon pop culture, we can gain very important insights into Mormon culture as a whole. So what are the angles that we could take or bring to bear on Mormon pop culture? There are, as I see it, three primary divisions of Mormon pop culture. There is the Mormon who, we'll say product, created by a Mormon for a Mormon, which is obviously the most prolific or the one that the type of pop culture we see the most of. There's then also a Mormon writing for or producing something for a non-Mormon audience, which we're beginning to see more and more of in the trade book industry, for example. And then we have an emerging division, I believe, of pop culture and Mormonism, where a non-Mormon is producing a product to be consumed by Mormons. This is yet in its infancy, but I think we do see some indications that the Christian book industry, for example, or non-Mormons in general, are seeking out Mormons as consumers. A few words on Mormons producing work for the non-Mormon or American pop culture market, and then I'll look at Mormons specifically. In the last few years, there have been a number of Mormons who have succeeded at getting a book on the New York Times bestseller list. We're all, of course, familiar with Stephen R. Covey's very influential Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which has remained for almost 7 or 8 years on the New York Times bestseller list. But there is also Betty J. Eddy's Embraced by the Light, which has stirred controversy among Mormons, but also reached millions of American readers. There is Richard Paul Evans and his two books, the first entitled The Christmas Box, which have sold in the millions. Orson Scott Card leads just about, I guess you could say, leads the science fiction genre itself. Ann Perry, a Mormon mystery writer, likewise leads that genre. And then we have books by Linda and Richard Iyer on parenting, and many others that booksellers we would call mid-list titles, that is, books that don't reach the bestseller list but are very successful. All of these authors are identified in their jackets, that is, the dust jackets in their books, as either Mormon or something like Mormons. They're not always identified as such. And their readers probably don't realize the source of the ideas that these Mormon writers are conveying. But it is certain that we Mormons, or Mormons as readers, do interpret them a little bit differently than Americans as a whole. And this would, I believe, be something to consider that we won't look into today, but that how do we Mormons read, or how do Mormons read Seven Habits of Highly Effective People? We know how we responded to Embraced by the Light because of the various, papers and such that resulted from that. But how do we read these bestsellers? What do they mean to us individually? So putting aside then Mormons who create products for the national market, let's look at Mormons creating products for Mormon consumption. The Christian book industry is led by an association known as the Christian Book Association, which has very clear objectives that are outlined by Colleen McDonnell in this book, Material Christianity, as follows. She's quoting here a bookstore manager. Our ministry is really in the message of the products we sell, clarifies the owner of a store that conducts 2 million in annual sales. Good Christian products change lives. So if we emphasize sales, getting as much product as possible into the hands of as many people as possible, we expand our ministry dramatically. We can't make one-on-one ministry our primary focus and be successful. We need to focus on reaching people with products and let the products minister to customers' needs. For the consumer, the bookstore owner, and the supplier, Christian retailing is a religious activity, as it is in the Mormon or LDS book industry. In a fairly recent publication of the LDS Booksellers Association, we read, this is in the president's message, the president in, 1993, Bob Bluth of Chapter and Verse Bookstore in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He writes, "If I had all the answers to life's questions, I would be willing and able to spread wisdom and hence success throughout the world, which would include the LDS Booksellers Association. We are all engaged in a great work, focused on the building of the kingdom of God and spreading the gospel throughout the world. Hopefully, the blessings of a monetary nature will accompany our efforts. There is nothing wrong with a business venture that also focuses on the work of the kingdom. May God bless us to these ends for our great efforts in the missionary movement." This is a commercial publication destined for booksellers, but yet its rhetoric is precisely what one would find in a sacrament meeting talk, as we find in that comment, or rather the quotation, in Colleen McDonnell's Material Christianity. For Christian booksellers, it's a ministry. For Mormon booksellers, it's a mission. And this mission takes on very interesting qualities. I, as I mentioned, work at a bookstore in Logan where we have a number of seasoned booksellers who have for years been disseminating good Mormon books and merchandise. One among us has been there for 25 years, and for her job is, in fact, a mission. It's a calling. I refer to her privately as the bishop of the store. She, in her calling, has done a number of good works. Recently, she contacted one of our customers who had reneged on a debt to explain, you can file for bankruptcy on earth, but you'll be found guilty in heaven, more or less condemning him for his failure to uphold his religious ideals. Recently, when some would-be drug users came in to purchase the olive vials that we sell for olive oil, she realized that their purpose was not to store oil, but rather drugs, and so she refused to sell the merchandise to them. Some years ago, the word, or rather the phrase, choose the right, that appears on the rings we know so well, choose the right rings, was being reinterpreted by a number of youth in Cache Valley to mean corrupt the righteous. When she recognized these types of customers coming to purchase the rings, she would refuse to sell them. So such is the mission of this bishop, but a single LDS bookstore or bookstore that sells LDS merchandise, but she is not alone. There are many who, like her, believe that they are called to serve in a calling in a bookstore. In fact, this LDS Booksellers Association will convene here in Salt Lake City next week for their annual convention. I have to confess that I got involved in the act as a recently returned missionary. I felt like it would be appropriate to make available to non-Mormon customers or Mormons buying books for non-members the phone numbers for the missionaries in the Cache Valley area. So I got a directory and made sure it was available right there at the front desk so we could, at the drop of a hat, give a would-be investigator the phone number for the missionaries. As we all know, to enter an LDS bookstore or any bookstore in Utah can be to enter a menagerie of Mormon popular culture. Not only do we find books by general authorities, but there are CD recordings by Mormon musicians, jewelry, sculpture, and a variety of other merchandise. This is largely the result of aggressive booksellers who have, and this this organization I refer to, the LDS Booksellers Association, which have welcomed in all of these various sidelines. In fact, I'll read for you a listing of just some of the categories that this association believes it is to promote or at least to authorize. Archival supplies, audio CDs for sign language, calligraphy quotes, flannel stories, hats and shirts, of course, pillowcases, rubber stamps, stickers, decals and signs, missionary tags, temple cases, temple replicas, wood vials, and so forth. These are just 15 or so of the 300 different products this organization believes should be in an LDS bookstore. There is a story that I think may be a kind of apocryphal about Bruce Hafen and his experience putting writing and then having published his book, The Broken Heart. He was evidently very concerned about the manuscript at one stage and was expressing his apprehension to the Deseret Book editor, who, impatient, explained, "It doesn't really matter, Bruce. They're not going to read the book. It's simply a gift that is very often packaged in a candy wrapper-like dust jacket that, again, we recognize very well, that is, in fact, more destined for a bookshelf than anyone's hands." The CTR acronym is everywhere in Mormon merchandising. It appears, of course, on rings, but in other formats as well, both authorized by the church and unauthorized. Recently, there has been an emergence of another idiom that seems to take Mormons or inspire Mormons, and that is return with honor. I'm holding here a RWH ring, which is almost equally popular as the CTR ring. The question I have, and that any young bookseller should have in mind, is what's the next big idiom? What's the next three-letter word or three-letter acronym that will make thousands or even millions of dollars for LDS merchants or producers? Though it would seem that Mormon music, that is, more music that we would consider schmaltzy or somehow less artistic, is all the same, it is not. And an experience I've had, once again involved with this bookstore, but more encountering the musicians that create this music, illustrates this. The Kent Concert Hall at Utah State University frequently welcomes LDS performers that tour Utah and surrounding areas of Mormon country, performing their latest album. On one occasion, Lex de Azevedo was joined by his wife, or rather his daughter Julie, and Kenneth Cope, I think it was, for a performance of what Mormons would expect to be Mormon music. That is the uplifting, entertaining, and inspirational music that we seek in this format. At that time, Lex de Azevedo had just produced an album by the title of Moab, I believe, which was nothing but jazz with no recognizable Mormon elements to it. He began the concert by performing selections from Moab. By intermission, the exodus was nearly complete. Everyone was leaving, offended, demanding refunds for their tickets. A year later, the two men behind Afterglow, the group that cites scripture then sings to you, were performing the same Kent Concert Hall selections from a new album they'd produced that contained nothing but country music. And in fact, the album cover showed them in country uniform, and it was to be expected they'd be performing country music. But the concert had been pitched a little differently. It was Afterglow that was performing, not these two country singers. Once again, a good deal of the audience left angry, demanding refunds by intermission. So what we learn, I think, from this is that Mormon music, what is described as ear candy by some people, does have certain qualities to it that its listeners anticipate or expect, and that if they're not delivered, they will not consume it. To me, Deseret Book is one of the most interesting entities in the Mormon or LDS book industry that we can look at to gain insights into Mormon pop culture, because they are the big producer. They, as we know, operate a publishing division, a multimedia division. They have a record label. And then, of course, we know their chain bookstores that surround Utah and throughout the U.S. They also have a discount store. They do online sales. They have a mail order and book club. They are enormous. To gain some insight into their influence or their largesse, I would have to compare them to something that doesn't exist, but I'll illustrate. In the trade book industry, that is the books that you find in a typical bookstore, we have Random House, which operates four massive divisions, which together dominate something like 26% of the trade book industry. Huge, but not that big, so to speak. Deseret Book would be, if in the trade book industry, something like Random House combined with Barnes & Noble, the country's largest chain, linked with Amazon.com, the most profitable, not yet profitable, but successful online bookstore, together with the Book of the Month Club, again, a large entity in that industry, and perhaps a discount store chain. That is how influential and possibly detrimental, but sometimes positive, Deseret Book is in this LDS book industry. What would be interesting is for anyone, I suppose, but someone who would be church-friendly, to take a look at some of the antitrust laws that are associated with operating on several levels of an industry, as Deseret Book does. It may be that they'd be found to be in violation of those laws. So if a publisher like Deseret Book and a bookstore chain and everything else that they are is so monolithic, so influential, what exactly do they do to our popular culture? What books do we read or have amongst us that we would not have if they didn't exist, or more frightening to me anyway, what do we not have because of Deseret Book? What do they censor from us, that is Mormon consumers? What do they promote that really may not deserve promotion? Again, I think Deseret Book is an entity to look at that I've only seen one book treat in any systematic way, that is their role in Mormon culture. What of the Salt Lake Distribution Center, which serves its English-speaking clientele here in the U.S. Very thoroughly, but only but those in the international church only selectively. That is, they only can provide in Swahili this or that. So we ask the question, what comes first, or what do the Swahili saints receive first, Together Forever in video, or LeGrand Richards' classic A Marvelous Work and a Wonder? What are the implications for the international church by our having in Salt Lake City an institution that more or less decides what pop culture or church doctrine they receive and in what formats? InfoBase's recent acquisition of Bookcraft, to me, raises a number of questions. Bookcraft is, of course, known as a reputable publisher, not unlike Deseret Book. They published McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. They are the publisher for Boyd K. Packer. They're known for conservatism and good management. They were recently bought out by InfoBases, a company that's a little more aggressive, that has demonstrated a lack of scruples on a few occasions over the last few years. What will result? Will we have the Steed family, the protagonist family of The Work and the Glory, in disc form sometime soon, linked with what we know as the InfoBases Collector's Library, 1997. This piece of work itself, to me, raises all kinds of questions. I believe that in years from now, as we look back at this period in our history, this will be associated or considered as influential as word processing software. This, I believe, will affect our understanding of our doctrine and how we interpret it to one another more than anything else. Imagine what a convert to the church must find when they key in a word search, blood, perhaps together with atonement, and suddenly find what Brigham Young was saying in the 19th century. For literary critics, this, I believe, has a lot of implications. The intertextuality that it creates, with B.H. Roberts here, Joseph William McConkie there, Hugh Nibley over yonder, all accessible by a single keyword search, to me it's fascinating to think what can happen and what it's doing to Mormons across the Wasatch Front and beyond. It has been immensely successful, and so it's certain that it is influencing individual Mormon families. For that matter, what do we make of InfoBase's acquisition of the company known for Ancestry and the Red Book and the Source? These are well-known genealogy publications that they bought outright last year, I believe it was, furthering Mormon influence in the world of genealogy, maybe to the point of, again, monopoly. Just a few thoughts on when Mormon culture goes bad and Mormon advertising, and then I'll conclude. What does happen when a work of Mormon pop culture is consumed, then the creator is found to be somehow deviant or not up to the ideals of his or her creation? We all recognize the fallout that resulted from the Paul H. Dunn debacle, but we don't know of the very, I'm sure, many creators of Mormon pop culture who themselves have been found deviant. I grew up in Logan and went to Logan High School, where there was a student body president who was well known and respected, part of the seminary council and so forth, who produced this, Whisperings of the Spirit, what I believed at that time to be a very eloquent rendering of my faith that influenced me into going on a mission and being a good Latter-day Saint. This Mark Furlong, like myself, served a mission, then married, but soon after his marriage, divorced and took up the lifestyle that evidently he had wanted to lead for many years, which was that of homosexuality. How do I, looking back on the influence this work had on me, reckon with the fact that the Creator has left the faith? What do we do with an Isaiah Bennett, a Catholic priest who converted to the church together with one of his parishioners, then just after this recording was produced? This is an inspirational talk tape where he gives his conversion story and his wife joins him in it. A week after this was distributed, he reneged on his conversion, if you will, and asked for a recall of this cassette, so we booksellers were forced to send it back. This is a fascinating piece of work, but what does it mean to those who did actually buy it and consume it? These are just examples of many, I believe, who have been involved in creating Mormon pop culture, but who have then left the culture. Mormon advertising is, again, something that will be worthy of close analysis. I'm sure we who watch General Conference quite enjoy the commercials that follow, like we would those that follow the Super Bowl. These are the big commercials that must cost their makers quite a bit of money. That is Emergency Essentials reminding us to prepare our food storage, Bookcraft selling us a book by General Authority who had just spoken to us in conference, and so forth. In conclusion, I turn back to the statement of Michael Austin in his essay entitled In Praise of Mormon Schmaltz, where he makes, I think, a final resounding statement about the importance of looking at Mormon pop culture. Mormon literary critics, I think, stand to lose out on a great opportunity for cultural analysis by asking the wrong questions of works like Saturday's Warrior and Charlie. Rather than asking ourselves, is it good art, which almost always turns out to be a fancy version of the question, do I like it, we should be asking ourselves why these works of literature have endured for so many years in a culture that is not generally known for its literary traditions. Works like this have struck a real chord with the members of our community, and those of us who want to study the ways that Mormonism interacts with literature would do well to accept the fact, that fact, and start to take them seriously. And I would expand his call to look at works of Mormon fiction to all forms of Mormon popular expression, music, visual arts, and all of the variety of merchandise that I've referred to in my remarks. I'll now turn to our next panelist, Tom Kimball, who is a book buyer at Benchmark Books here in Salt Lake City, and I'll ask him and the other panelists to make a few remarks about why they've chosen to be in the panel and what they have to say.
There's a book called A Gentle Madness. It's a history of book collecting, and in it describes two types of book people, the bibliophile and the bibliomane. One's the master and one's the slave. I enjoy meeting authors, reading books, everything that has to do with books, and especially discussing books. And so for me, this is an opportunity to feed my disease. In 1980, Desert Book approached Jack Welch and asked him to write a novel, and that book was a book called Charlie. Now, Charlie's a book about a young returned missionary named Sam. And as soon as he gets home from his mission, he's forced by his father to go out with this girl. Well, there's a small problem. That is that Charlie's not a member of the church, and Sam's this enthusiastic return missionary. He wants to go on, or he wants to get married in the temple. Wants to go to BYU. He wants to do the whole nine yards, and he finds himself falling for this girl who's not even a member of the church. So the way he solves the problem is he just converts her. During their relationship, they become engaged, and during this time, she confesses to him that she's not a virgin. This distresses him once again because he wants to be this picture-perfect lifestyle, and it gets to a point where he actually says to her that he doesn't want used merchandise. At this point, they have a breakup. Later on, they have a reconciliation. They get married. They have a kid. Charlie contracts cancer and dies. And that's when book number two comes up. Okay, book two is about how Sam meets a return missionary lady. They get married. He extols the virtue of home teaching and community service. At the end of the book, he depicts Sam at a retirement home. He's got a clown outfit on. He's playing a banjo, and he's volunteering his time, and everybody's happy, and everything's kind of hunky-dory. Well, since then, Jack Wayland, and I think books in general, LDS pop fiction in general, has evolved over the past two decades. It's been gradual. This is one of Jack Wayland's next books. It discusses in it the topic of being a foster child, being abandoned by a parent. Certainly, he's starting to approach some issues in this book, although everybody in his wake starts to join the church. In The Understudy, it deals with divorce. And an interesting anomaly in LDS theology, this young man joins the church and is taught that he will, he can get married and have his wife and family forever and ever. Well, he marries a widower, and she's already married for time and all eternity. Certainly an interesting twist to the story. Then we come to what I consider a landmark book in LDS fiction in general. Sarah is an 11-year-old girl. She's repeatedly raped by her stepfather and molested. By the age of 15, she becomes pregnant by him. the government steps in and takes her out of the home and moves her into a foster home right next to our hero, Travis. Now, Travis is also 15 years old, and he befriends this beautiful girl that just moves next door, and he doesn't quite understand what's going on, but he tries to befriend her and eventually finds out exactly what had happened. A lot of people will look at this book in different ways. Being a guy, I look at the book through Travis's eyes. A lot of girls will probably look through the book through Sarah's eyes. Sarah, at this point, goes through counseling, and the book depicts the counseling. It also depicts her father is indicted and goes to trial for what he did to her. At the trial, the lawyers make her, as well as her mom, sort of turns her back on her, makes her out to be the bad guy, to be the slut and the whore, and the stepfather is acquitted. She also has the baby and gives the baby up for adoption. Well, Travis, who the person who I relate to in the book personally, here's this young boy. He's trying his best because he likes this girl, and there's a budding romance going on between these two people. He's trying to do everything he can to make this girl comfortable, to make her happy, and to make her feel welcome. Well, at school, when his friends find out that his new girlfriend is pregnant, they obviously think that it's his, and start spreading rumors. And the story is about this boy who loses his reputation, who loses his youth. He gives up, basically all of his proms and all that because of his association with this girl. He can't tell his friends the truth because that's a secret. And everything he does, he just tries to do for this girl. And even to the point where they when she comes back to school after having the baby, he's trying to defend her honor and to try to hide the ridicule from her that people are pointing towards her. To the point where they actually try to run off and get married. They were unsuccessful in this. But you see this boy who's just trying to do what's right. He's trying to take care of her. He's trying to do something that's right. And what he doesn't realize is that he's smothering Sarah in the process. And he doesn't realize that he's doing harm to her as well. Well, he goes on to go to serve a mission, and he keeps writing to his childhood sweetheart. And three-fourths of the way through his mission, he gets a Dear John from her, and she tells him that she's going to be married the day after he gets home from his mission. I was going to tell you the end, but maybe I won't. This is for sale. I work at Benchmark Books. certainly, this was a for me, and from what I see this was a landmark turning point in LDS fiction. It influenced other books. Before I say that, Jack Williams' next book is a book called Brittany, and it's another evidence of this evolution. Brittany, I've only read the blurb about what it's going to be about. It's about date rape. And there was some sense that there was going to be a discussion about the nitty-gritty of what happens during that and also the aftermath, like the medical examination and so forth. I look forward in the future to seeing other significant issues being discussed in LDS books. My hope is that one day there will be some discussion in these books about discrepancies in history, LDS history, and possibly theology, but done in a believing and non-whiny way. If I were to do a fiction book about these things, it would be very whiny. But I don't portray myself as being an author or a fiction writer. There's a book called, it's written on the market right now, it came out at Christmas time, it's called Ariana, The Making of a Queen. It's written by a lady by the name of Nuns. And in this book, you have Ariana on her wedding night, and it takes place in Paris. And Ariana is crying because her husband has chosen to do drugs and to drink with with his friends instead of spending her wedding night with her. The book depicts their progression into drugs and alcohol, specifically his. She becomes pregnant and has a baby and gets herself cleaned up. And you see Antoine, her husband's, ongoing and ever-increasing drug habit. She decides that she needs to break away from him. And at this point, she goes to the older couple And, of course, the missionary step in. She joins the church, sort of the older couple, and everyone within like a five-block radius. But at this time, the husband comes back and says, I'm going to try and make things better. He has a show of money. He doesn't tell her that he's now a dealer, and this is where he's getting the money from. But he's trying to make a reconciliation. During this time, she's trying to go to school, and her young child is with the babysitter. Now, during this story, she does a really good job of building the characters of Ariana and her baby Antoinette. And you just really sense that there's a good bond there, she does a really good job of building the characters. Well, Antoine comes and picks up the baby at the babysitter's and takes her to a party. At this party, the baby starts crying, and while Antoine is on heroin, he doesn't know really how to solve or to get the child to stop crying, and so he gives the child a lethal dose of heroin. The book depicts Ariana having to go to the hospital and identify her baby, her dealing with the emotional issues, as well as the physical issues of her losing a baby, of having milk in her breasts that is a constant reminder that she has that her baby is not there anymore. From here, the book turns a lot more fluffy, but certainly a book that was influenced by books like Jack Whalen that are trying to talk about more current issues. There's a series of books called The Work and the Glory. Well, the idea behind those books comes from a series of books by Lee Nelson. It's called the Storm Testament series. There's several volumes in it. The first volume in the book, or in the series, describes a young man by the name of Dan Storm. He's sort of a Tom Sawyer type. He helps a runaway slave, and he runs and lives with the Indians for a while. He comes here to Utah and lives in the mountains, and in the end of the book, he goes and moves back east and goes back and live with the Mormons. Well, even within that series, there's an evolution taking place. Later volumes discuss polygamy, which is interesting because, you know, I know of at least two biographies about Brigham Young, specifically Preston Nibley's, that never states the P word. here's a whole novel about it. It also discusses whorehouses in Salt Lake in the late 1870s and early 80s. And there's an entire book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I read this book when I was, I don't know, 18, 19. And as a dealer of books in theology, biographies, and histories, certainly this was my introduction to the Mountain Meadow Massacre. Even though it's done in an apologetic way, and maybe his conclusions are his own, certainly for a 19-year-old, I wouldn't have had an opportunity to have experienced that or learned much about that at that age in any other medium. Well. As a book dealer, I enjoy the history. I enjoy the biographies and the theology books. But I find these books to be a great release and an entertainment for 3 or 4 hours. You know, I'm a mainstream believing Mormon again, and that's why I feel that they are of value. Thank you.
Our next panelist, Elizabeth Smart, is a lecturer with the Department of English at Utah State University, and completed her master's degree in American Studies with, I believe, an emphasis in folklore just this year.
So John was saying, is this good sound? Okay. John was saying earlier that a lot of times we feel the need when discussing pop culture to sort of justify that discussion, and that's essentially one of the first classes you have as a graduate student in folklore, is how to justify studying folklore and trying to justify folklore as a field of study, because a lot of times people assume that when you have a degree in it, then you would be the first person on someone's invitation list to a campfire sing-along, because that's apparently what the degree qualifies you to do. Yet actually, folklore is the study of everyday culture, the things, the traditions, the material culture, and the beliefs that we have in our everyday lives that shape our lives, and yet sometimes seem trivial and so are overlooked, and yet because of the widespread nature of our folk traditions and beliefs, they do seem to merit some study. Let me find the proper place for me to begin. I'm a bit shaky, not because of the symposium, but because I spent yesterday morning trimming a hedge with one of those automatic chainsaw-looking trimmers, and it kind of took all my strength away. So, anyway, please excuse my shakiness. I have really only a few distinct memories of what we're calling Mormon schmaltz. Mostly my parents shielded me and my siblings from those kinds of influences. But when I was 10, I did sing I'm the One Who Writes My Own Story from the musical My Turn on Earth as a duet with my sister in sacrament meeting. There was the time that I cried while reading the book Star Child. I don't even know who wrote that. I can't remember. But a similar storyline as Charlie, there, except it's a wayward LDS young man and a very kind and seminary teacher's daughter that fall in love, and then the young man dies. But his friend that he met in the pre-existence later meets up with the girlfriend, and they get married, and that's the part that I cried. Then there was this, and I was reading, happened to be reading Star Child as I was driving down to Provo. I grew up in northern Idaho, and my parents were very supportive of us as youth and wanted us to have that Academy for Girls experience, that Boys World of Adventure experience that BYU, I think, probably still sponsors. So this was a real pivotal trip because I read Star Child and I was on my way to Academy for Girls. But, again, mostly my parents shielded us from these influences because we were busy being culturally superior. We set a place at the dinner table for public radio so we could be joined by Beethoven or Stravinsky or Barber. And that's a treat when you're having a hamburger to have Stravinsky at the other end of the table. On the yearly temple trip to Seattle, my sisters and I opted one year with my father to attend the ballet where Alexander Gudinov was performing, wearing our gauzy floor-length gunny sacks dresses rather than just go to the carnival rides with everyone else. So these were the things that I was brought up with more so than the Mormon literature. And so because of that, not because of my parents, but just there's a certain hardness, I think, that develops when you're sort of a cynical preteen and teen. That kind of cynicism can be sort of hard to crack, but that's, I think, what developed with me and with my family. But so now when I'm sitting in church, I fidget when people start reading Footprints in the Sand. I cringe when people start telling the story of the young man who dies and goes to the spirit world and is interviewed and ask the question, tell me what you know about Christ. And the young man, a student of the Bible, is able to name places and significant sermons and important events associated with the ministry of Christ, after which the interviewer thanks him and sends him on his way. The next interviewee, again, approaches the interview table, and the interviewer asks, tell me what you know about Christ, at which point the person who is being interviewed recognizes the interviewer as the Savior, falls to the Savior's feet, weeps, and cries, my Lord, my Savior. Those are the kinds of stories that make me walk out and get a drink or something. Again, usually when I see a porcelain figure of a temple or some kind of statuette in someone's living room, I think, couldn't you put that in the bedroom instead of in the living room? But I think there's something about these attitudes that prevents me and others from recognizing the belief that is significant in these cultural icons. And I think a lot of the belief that supports these kinds of expressions of faith in print and in music and in art really is the folk belief that arises from the religious belief of Mormonism. Folk belief, then, by folk belief I don't mean some kind of quaint or smarmy old wives' tale kind of thing that we dismiss easily as being antiquated and out of touch, but folk belief being traditional beliefs that are circulated usually by word of mouth, held by members of groups of people, small groups of people. LDS Church is not necessarily a small group of people, and yet I think there is sort of a common, certain common beliefs that we hold that are not found in the standard works. I'm going to depart from our conversation about pop culture for a moment and talk about folk culture. Again, to differentiate folk culture from pop culture, If you think of pop culture as something that has depth of, or is can be spread over space, things that are produced by, that are mass-produced, things like the Rubik's Cube, and we all can think of a lot of examples of pop culture, whereas folk culture has depth of time and space, ideas that can be spread across a large area or over large groups of people, but then also has a certain tradition, certain amount of tradition that accompanies that. For example, actually the story of the interviewer, I think, is an example of a folk expression of religious belief. Another story that maybe you have heard in church is the young man, these are always men in these stories, this young man who's admiring the, except maybe in liberated wards, is admiring the Grand Canyon, and the strong wind comes up behind him and blows him off the edge of the Grand Canyon, and he's falling, and he manages to catch a branch as he's falling on his way down. At which point he starts praying, if not sooner, and says, "Heavenly Father, please help me out of this situation." And he hears a voice, it's that still small voice, that says, "Do you believe that I am all-powerful and that I created this wind that blew you off the cliff?" And, of course, humbled by the situation, the young man responds, "Well, of course, I have faith in thee, I've always believed in thee." And then there's a long period of silence. And meanwhile, the young man is still praying, "Please help me." And then the voice comes back and says, "Well, do you believe that I could create a wind that would blow you back up to the top of the cliff?" And, of course, once again, humbled by the situation, the young man, and I'm certain feeling his faith, says, "Of course, I believe that your power can save me in any situation." And again, there's a long period where nothing happens. And then, meanwhile, the young man is wondering, when am I going to be saved? And he hears this small voice again in his ear that says, "Let go of the branch." I've heard this story several times, usually in a testimony-bearing kind of situation, and people use this kind of story, this kind of popular parable or folk parable to express this belief in a trusting God, in a loving God, and in a God who truly will get you out of the worst situation if you will only let go of that branch and allow him to do his work. So these, maybe just running with these two examples of the interviewer story and the being blown off the cliff story, you have to think, well, what kinds of folk beliefs are, or what kinds of beliefs do these stories illustrate, and what do these beliefs do for the believer? I think in both of these stories, you see the belief, and it's what we would consider doctrine, that it is that we can know God, that God is an accessible figure in our lives. And yet what these stories illustrate is that it takes spiritual perception to understand when we are meeting God. In the interviewer situation, the interviewee does not realize that he's speaking with Christ at first, the first figure, the first character. In the being blown off the cliff story, the guy hanging onto the branch doesn't truly recognize God's power until he is told to let go. So there's this belief, I think, that doesn't ever really state in the scriptures anywhere that you must be incredibly spiritually aware for that one moment when you encounter God, and yet that seems to be a belief that a lot of Mormons have based on a lot of stories that are told. A lot of Three Nephite legends that are shared also express this belief that you need to be you need to have an acute spiritual perception. And what folklore does, the study of folklore, doesn't look necessarily at the truth of stories. Obviously, the story about the interviewer is not true, and probably the story about the guy being blown off the cliff isn't true. So we don't look at whether or not those stories are true, but we look at how come people tell those stories. How come I've heard each of those stories dozens of times in sacrament meeting? And that seems to be the significant point of discussion, is why do people continue to tell these stories? And what do these stories convey about Mormon faith or about the individuals who are telling them? I think one thing that's interesting, that actually, to quote Bert Wilson, a Mormon folklorist, he says, "To understand contemporary Mormon folklore, one must understand that Mormons consider themselves a peculiar people, a kingdom apart, living the world but not of it. They believe they belong to the one true church, a church lost through apostasy following the death of Christ but later restored by revelation from God to Joseph Smith, and they believe they have an obligation through vigorous missionary work to share the restored gospel with the world. The bulk of Mormon folklore functions to persuade church members that these beliefs are valid and that individuals must devote themselves valiantly to the cause. Indeed, may suffer dire consequences if they fail to do so. In brief, this folklore falls into two broad categories: lore that shows how God protects the church in its battle with the world, and lore, remarkably like that of the early Puritans, that shows how God brings about conformity to church teachings by intervening directly with the lives of church members. And he continues, one of the best ways to prove the validity of a cause is to prove that God is on one side. And I think that this is a challenge that Mormons take very seriously, is the challenge of proving that God is on our side. And we are encouraged to preach the gospel, and we are also encouraged to develop a relationship with God that brings us closer to him through following Christ's teachings, which is actually quite a daunting task, to feel that you are able to not only proclaim your faith, but be able to proclaim it in a way that you show that you are sort of on that path that you're saying others should take. So going back to a few of these popular examples that I mentioned earlier, footprints in the sand, it's interesting. Even though I dislike the form of that sentiment, I do think that the sentiment expressed is very important and provides a way for people to express this idea of faith and also encouragement that others should that others can latch on to this faith. I teach an advanced essay writing class up at Logan, and one of my students, just in the last batch of essays that I graded, talked about the anger that she felt after her grandmother's death, and yet this poem, Footprints in the Sand, was very instrumental in her feeling better about herself and better about her family, and because of the anger that this grandmother's death had caused. Going back to that song, I'm the One Who Writes My Own Story, a look at the lyrics, the chorus goes, I'm the one who writes my own story. I decide the person I'll be. What goes in the plot and what will not is pretty much up to me. Now you think that actually, whether or not it's tuneful, actually expresses some of the most vibrant attitudes that we encounter in Mormonism, especially considering that the song is sung by a young girl, and she's saying, I'm the one that writes my own story. I decide the person I'll be, and you know, this is happening back in the 70s, and you think, well, how can I dismiss that as invaluable or as not as valuable just because it's sort of maybe not a Beethoven tune, and yet the ideas expressed really do provide a lot of meaning for not only young people, but I think people who now, sort of my generation, who kind of maybe grew up with that and then continue with this idea of writing one's own story. I think essentially, a lot of these popular icons provide symbols and ways that we can express our faith. I am certain, I'll go ahead and make this leap, I'm certain that all of us have been in situations where we have had difficulty expressing our deepest feelings of faith. I certainly have been in testimony meetings where I sit down and I think, why did I even stand up there? Because all I've done is come across saying those same cliche things and no one understands exactly what my testimony means to me. A lot of times we put a lot of value and belief in a particular icon or symbol that represents that meaning for us, which is something we're accustomed to as members of the church every Sunday when we take the sacrament. We're essentially putting a lot of meaning into symbols of bread and water. One symbol I wanted to just close with, I was speaking with my mom about a week ago, and she said, we were talking about popular images, and she said, well, do you remember that copper temple that I had, that I kept, or I had in my hope chest, I think it was in her cedar chest, and I didn't remember, but she... And I asked her to tell me the story about it. And she said, well, when I was growing up in southern Idaho, one of my friends brought back a copper replica of the Salt Lake Temple as a souvenir from the trip. And that meant a lot to me. It symbolized my future, my relationship with God, what I hoped that it would be. And it had a lot of meaning for me. And as we were cleaning out, we've done a lot of moving in the last 10 years, my family has. And I was preparing for this next move, you saw that copper temple, and you said, Mom, why don't you just get rid of that? Why would you want that? And which I can see myself saying, back that cynical teenage years. And so through my encouragement, she decided, well, maybe we'll just go ahead and get rid of the temple. And then she told me what it had meant to her, this symbol of hope, this symbol of wanting always to be reaching for something more. And I said, well, maybe, trying to make things better, because I felt bad that I had encouraged her to get rid of it. Now I do. I said, well, maybe does your present situation, your current situation, is it at all what you pictured your future would be like? Is that any compensation that perhaps you're living that future that you had dreamed of and as a girl? And she said, well, and I always have appreciated my mother's frankness. She said, well, not really. And I don't think that is a sad thing. I think we all have hopes and dreams and visions for ourselves that we will never attain, that we symbolize sometimes in a physical manner. And that, I think, is the value of that symbol, is it's a constant reminder of those things that will be, or those things that can be. And I think for my mom, that temple was a symbol of that. And certainly, I don't think that that means that those dreams and that vision is no longer there, because the temple isn't there. And yet, in a faith where there is so little doctrine and yet so much doctrine, the idea that we can become like God and yet we have so far to go. Somewhere in the middle, I think there needs to be a mediation of expressing those feelings. And a lot of times I think that mediation comes in the form of folk expression or in pop culture expression that provides sort of a mediating middle ground for that discussion to begin. And it provides a way for people to practice expressing their faith. And so that, I think, is a lot of the value of a lot of popular culture. Leaving aside the question of aesthetic value, it does provide a forum for that expression of significant relationships with others and with God.
Tracy Smith is at work on a forthcoming history of WKRP in Cincinnati, the television show. He writes for the Television Chronicles and is going to begin coursework at Portland State University this fall. For a PhD, I should say.
Thanks, John. Those are really tough acts to follow. I'm going to attempt to trace the origin of the LDS musical, and thanks to Deseret Industries, I have some visuals to show you along the way. So I want to go back to 1967 to start. 1967 was somewhat of a watershed year for popular culture in America. It was the year of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, Come On Baby, Light My Fire, R.E.S.P.E.C.T., and the plethora of films with a more mature theme. Newspapers and trades tumbled over themselves trying to name the best picture of the year. There was In the Heat of the Night, about murder in a racist southern town. Mrs. Robinson chased Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate. Truman Capote's In Cold Blood shocked viewers and impressed critics. Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway took the lion's share of the media coverage for their violent and seemingly progressive take on Bonnie and Clyde. Cool Hand Luke, Wait Until Dark, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner were also in the running. But the predecessor to The Ensign, The New Era, took a defensive stance. None of these films were appropriate for Best Picture, it claimed. The LDS magazine declared that Walt Disney's Follow Me, Boys was, with avuncular actor Fred McMurray, the best film of 1967. It seemed to be the beginning of the new LDS attitude of fighting the mainstream. Since then, Utah communities have fought against acclaimed national hits with R ratings, like Salt Lake City's 1973 reaction to the showing of Last Tango in Paris, and also Logan's battle to stop the playing of Looking for Mr. Goodbar in 1977. Also in 1977, Salt Lake's Channel 4 chose not to air early episodes of the controversial comedy Soap. The syndicated Mary Hartman, never graced the airwaves of Zion. Just last year, church-owned KSL Channel 5, home of Sunday's Music and the Spoken Word, opted not to broadcast the daring 20-year-old NBC staple Saturday Night Live. Music also gained scrutiny. A Provo radio station made national headlines in 1981 by banning the Olivia Newton-John song Physical for having suggestive lyrics. For a number of years, cable companies in Idaho Falls and Rexburg have tape-delayed MTV in order to censor undesirable segments. This is not to say that the LDS audience is not a full-fledged consumer at theaters and record stores, far from. But with the admonition to stay away from R-rated films and questionable music, it is not surprising that an alternative musical culture blossomed in the 1970s. So what were we to do during that age of bell bottoms and sideburns? The rowdy youngsters who wanted to play Kiss records or Heart were encouraged to try something a little more innocuous, lightweight, wholesome, maybe bland. Thanks to the DI, I have my first audiovisual. We were encouraged to play Donnie and Marie Osmond. As a 10-year-old in 1978, I was encouraged to like the Osmonds. They were ambassadors, I was told. We should turn out like this, not like Peter Frampton, not like Stevie Nicks, or even Sean Cassidy and Christy McNichol. I hope I'm not the only one who rejected this. My sister certainly enjoyed it. No self-respecting kid at Hillcrest Elementary played Donnie and Marie when there were cooler options like Hotel California by the Eagles or Rumors by Fleetwood Mac. Of course, there were many who were inclined to partake of this, and there were the LDS musicals also during this time, which flourished between 1973 and 81. Before 1973, the LDS scene had the Promised Valley and the venerable Mormon Tabernacle Choir, among others. But in my estimation, the LDS musical phase did not explode until a few catalysts from Broadway got the ball rolling. The first catalyst was the hippie manifesto Hair. Don't gasp out there. I was afraid someone was going to say, what? I realized that at the end of the first act, the cast strips naked, faces the audience, and obviously this isn't the part that influenced LDS musicals. However, in 1968, Hair was Broadway's first rock musical. I know Bye Bye Birdie was supposed to be a satire, but it was from the perspective of middle-aged parents. Hair was the real thing. The musical genre had dawned on a new age, besides the age of Aquarius. A couple of years later, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice put together the musical Jesus Christ Superstar, set during the last 7 days of Christ's life. The production showed human weaknesses in their portrayal of the Savior. Of course, Jesus Christ Superstar met with religious opposition, but was also praised for bringing the story to young people. It was a huge hit on Broadway and showed that religious themes and inspiring songs could plausibly speak to youth. Still, on a more fundamental level, Jesus Christ Superstar was viewed as blasphemous. Simultaneously, Godspell, with words and music by Stephen Schwartz, told the story of St. Matthew in a decidedly more sacrilegious way. Christ joined with the hippies in a Superman t-shirt and a clown face painted on. The idea for the musical came to the writer John Michael Tebleck when the long-haired youth was stopped by a policeman and searched for drugs after attending Easter services. The energetic musical was a hit, placing top 40 songs on the radio. With Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar, original cast and later soundtrack albums flourishing in record stores, and road company versions hitting America's heartland, the age of the modern religious musical had arrived. So you can guess what comes next. Enter One, Lex de Azevedo. The book and lyric by Doug Stewart and music by Azevedo. Saturday's Warrior, of course, it didn't take me long to find this at the DI. Started out as a college stage play in 1973 and turned into an LDS 1970s phenomenon. Line upon line, precept on precept, has echoed in Mormon cultural halls ever since. Although not exactly Mozart or even Gershwin or even Burt Bacharach, for that matter, Saturday's Warrior succeeded in reaching its Latter-day Saint audience with its story of predestined romance, chosen parents, and teen rebellion. And it's always really interesting to note how the chosen parents tend to be an LDS family in Bountiful or something instead of parents on crack in Brooklyn or something. Although far from doctrinally sound, the musical featured catchy, sappy songs that combined with the notion of an eternal purpose. People are known to cry in this musical. this from the musical that gave us We All Got Daddy's Nose. However hokey it may seem, it provided a source of esoteric entertainment that spoke to a Mormon audience's hopes, beliefs, faith, and trials. I once wanted to read a little bit of what the program said its mission statement was. Saturday's Warrior romanticizes the Mormon belief in a pre-existence, the promises that are made there, and the resulting mix-ups that occur in Earth life. In particular, the story deals with two people in love who vow to search the whole world over to find each other, a family of seven children that promises the youngest that she will not be forgotten, and two valiant spirits who make a pact to one day meet and become the world's greatest missionaries. I actually watched Saturday's Warrior again so I'd be refreshed on this, and I watched it with four other friends, and they were singing, and we were supposed to make fun of it like Mystery Science Theater, but actually they would say, but you can't make fun of this song. You know, so obviously it made an impact somewhere. A couple of years later, Azevedo teamed with lyricist Carolyn Pearson for the successful My Turn on Earth. Sprightly choreographed with a sort of a Charlie Brown quality, the musical rivals Saturday's Warrior for overall appeal. With five main characters, My Turn on Earth was more laid back and kid-oriented and managed to explore more more gospel territory. I'm the one who writes my own story, as Elizabeth has already pointed out. Other LDS musicals prospered during the age of Blue Eyeshadow. It's a Miracle, Star Child, Debbie. Others were less successful and have failed to last. There, I have an example of one of those that didn't last. Yesterday and Forever. The love story of Joseph Smith and Emma Hale hit the BYU campus in 1978 and has failed to generate much interest thereafter. Trying a bit to sound ultra-contemporary, Lynn Bryson wrote lyrics like this. I've got to read some of them. Yesterday and forever, my love, flowing on like a river, my love, I loved you then, and I still do, M. No way that I can change. My brother says that he can't watch LDS musicals that turn the likes of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young into song and dance men. Preach a little gospel, then dance the soft shoe. Well, if Joseph has a musical, do you know that the 70s had to also produce a Brigham Young musical? Which wasn't hard to find either. In April of 1976, the highly touted Brigham hit the Marriott Center. The author, Arnold Sungard, said, "This work is an attempt to trace the monumental persistence of a few dedicated believers who sought to fulfill the visionary belief of Joseph Smith that a joyful enlightenment through education is fundamental to man's understanding of his role in building the kingdom of God." The musical also saluted BYU, calling itself BYU Musical of the Century. Although better received than Yesterday and Forever, Brigham fell short of that lofty goal. During the 70s, that supposed renaissance of LDS musicals, even the church itself got into the action. The Department of Seminaries and Institutes produced Like Unto Us and The Quest, with modern, faith-inspiring jingles to aid in keeping the attention of students. At that time, it must have seemed that anyone who was at all musically inclined had a faith-promoting musical up his or her sleeve. Of course, as evidenced by the works of Michael McLean and salutes to the sesquicentennial, the LDS musical lives on, but not with the intensity or overkill as 20 years ago. Will these musicals last? Will Saturday's Warrior be merely a sign of the times, Mormonism 75? Or will they be passed on like an animated Disney film? Will they age like Jesus Christ Superstar, a quaint bit of bold hippie nostalgia? You couldn't pay a radio station to play the Osmonds today. After all, we thought that the Ogden and Provo temples were pretty groovy then. Now look at the architecture we're stuck with. Most of these musicals will not last, but thanks to theater arts at Ricks College or the sound of Sunday radio, The Saturday's Warrior and My Turn on Earth will likely last in some form. Seen as over-sentimental, sappy, and strident by many, LDS musicals served a purpose. They provided saints with entertainment that placed their unique outlook on life. Why was I born? Where am I going? Why is life so hard sometimes? There's no worrying about R-rated scenes or worldly philosophy, just expression of similar beliefs. With John's theme of defending LDS pop culture, it's not hard to see that the public consumes what they need. Thanks.
We now have some time for your comments, if you'd like to either direct them at us or just in general.
You mentioned that the work of the Glory was influenced by the other series. Is it a very short and very direct influence?
Well, the Storm Testament series was a historical fiction that went along with the history of the church. It followed the family of Dan Storm and eventually his sons and their romantic adventures and so forth. If you read the series, it's very clear that this is where Gerald Bunn got the idea from.
Have you explained that the Glory has become so popular? I've never heard of this. Maybe it was
actually in its day, it was very popular. In fact, this is still in print. This is 1980 when this came out. So certainly, for what it is, it certainly still sells and is sought after. Pretty good read.
Am I the only person in the universe who remembers a musical, like the Azevedo musical between Saturday's Warrior and Mike Runner called 1776? Does anybody else remember this?
I don't know that one.
No, well, that's different. I know that one. But no, this was definitely a Lexi Azevedo thing that was geared for Mormon audiences, and it came out in 1976. So when you're thinking of originates in 1969 or something like that. But I swear I went there. I was there.
He was very busy. He did so many that people don't remember anymore.
Yeah, my parents went to go see Saturday's Warrior, and they came back and they left us with babysitters. They came back and they said, "Oh, we should take the whole family." So the next time Lexi Azevedo came out with something, 1776. They brought the whole family along. It was terrible. Nobody can remember it. And I'm the only person in the universe that knows that it ever happened.
Yes.
I was born in 1967, so basically just like the story of my growing up. You know, I was, as a very small child, my cousins made home movies with the soundtrack by the Osmonds. All the Crazy Horses was our absolute favorite song. And, you know, in fifth grade, there was a survey in one of our classes. Somebody looked over my shoulder, and I was round and mocked for quite a long time afterwards because I stuffed my favorite TV show, The Dying Alicia. I grew up, you know, living for each issue of The New Era that would come out with a new song by Janis Cat Perry in it that I could sing. Or, you know, I sang In the Hollow of Thy Hand at missionary farewells. You know, this is my life, and I look back on this now with a great deal, you know, of shame, but also kind of a fond nostalgia, and I think that's our relationship in a large extent to this kind of Mormon kitsch, Mormon schmaltz, is something that we grow out of, something that we mature and grow to not like anymore, but that we look back on with fond appreciation for what it meant to us. But at the same time, people develop people who like the work of the Glory, my mother's age, so maybe
there's a certain extent that people
go down the road. And there are people like Austin who, you know, hardly embrace the Schmaltz side of it, whether that's their taste, and it's just as good as your taste. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to get back to the comment that you made when you were introducing the info basis. Both those InfoBasis CDs, I have heard that they bought Burton Bookcraft. Mm-hmm. I think I heard that they bought Ancestry. But when you said that your comment was that they aren't known, or they've been known to make decisions that weren't terribly scrupulous.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
More in the perception of professionals in the LDS book industry. Because they're a more nouveau company, they didn't go through the standard channels of distribution. Working directly with bookstores, they attempted to do the mail order thing or other means of reaching customers. And then also they were accused of playing games with pricing and essentially making it difficult for any book dealer to carry their product. And then they weren't forthcoming with information. There was just some controversy in the early 90s about InfoBasis, which was more or less brought to the board. It's been settled since then, but the idea is that Bookcraft is probably one of the most dependably reputable publishers there is, bought out by a company that's been known for being a little overly aggressive. So it's an interesting marriage. That's what I was driving at.
My question, I'm not quite sure what it is, but when you brought up interfaces, you mentioned like blood, Tolman, that certainly is not pop culture kind of thing.
No.
For the next 2 years now, we're going to be studying Brigham Young and priesthood meetings.
Right.
And in religious society, I'll bet you anyone who I have that they're not going to be talking about statements on blood, Tolman, so
right.
So I guess my question is how does that play in pop culture? Because when somebody looks up something in the info base, they see it all. Whereas the pop culture stuff that we'll see in the bookshelves, you don't get any of that.
Right.
The info base is really,
the technology that's right here is only a handful of years old. It's really, this is the very tip of what we're going to see in the future. Signature Books is coming out with their database with a folio engine by December. I think what we're going to see is that Joe Average in Sycamore, Alabama, joins the church, calls up for a signature database and maybe an info base, sits on his computer and pulls up, what about Adam? And he looks at Brigham Young statements on Adam and then Joseph Fielding Smith's statements on Adam. And, here's these people who are just, babies in the gospel, and they're going to be exposed to this immediately.
I guess my question is, why would that be brought up today? Because that seems to be a part of the problem. Why does that make it sophisticated?
I think I come from a commercial perspective when I say something to that effect. This is a packaged piece of pop culture that's made to be appealing. If you were to see the books that actually are inside of this, that are listed here, you would not want to touch them if you were either a novice in gospel study or even experienced. The General Discourse is still for sale, and it looks like that. You wouldn't want to touch that. But this, you can touch. It's appealing. It's like a cartoon in a way. And so it invites you into a world that you don't realize is there.
I see. I understand.
Right. It's a very good question.
But as he says, is that going to be broaden the intellectual basis of the church eventually?
It should have a very far-reaching effect.
I teach gospel background in my branch, and I found, I've tried to be very honest about this with the church has been about the feminists here, and I found that things I say don't surprise my students at all. And they're mostly people of my own generation, and we're raising up a new generation of members of the church who are very faithful and active Orthodox, but who are not, who are aware of the black spot on us.
Right.
Much more so than that. So I think
that
the general membership of the church
is
changing.
Here's one way of...
You don't live in Davis County.
No, I live in Portland, Oregon.
I think there's something, an issue that's come up a bit in our discussion, though, that I think is... I don't know that it's necessarily dangerous. I guess I just think that it's interesting. In cultural studies, there are a lot of different ways you can look at culture and how it develops. And one attitude is that culture evolves and that the culture of, say, 17th century peasants was somehow not as valuable as the culture that we have today in terms of how we express ourselves artistically or musically. And I think that can be sort of murky water when we get into making judgments about what, does culture evolve? Do we grow out of some things because we become more culturally elite or aware or have a better, a more excellent sense of aesthetics rather than looking at maybe why different cultural paradigms develop and valuing each paradigm for what it represents and the belief that it represents and how